Well, thanks again. I sure appreciate you talking with us.
I'm happy to. This is one of my favorite subjects in the whole world.
Well, I love the book, and I feel like you're maybe the only person that could have written this book.
Thank you. Well, I guess I was the person who had to write this book because of my life and the work I had done and my archives and my friendship with all the people involved. So it was a labor of love and a labor of choice.
I went back and rewatched your wonderful documentary on the making of Smile and the live concerts. A Beautiful Dreamer did such a wonderful job of telling the story, and the new book is such a great next chapter of that remarkable story. Looking back, hard to believe it's been 20 years now.
It's unbelievable that it's been they flew by. The documentary was essential for the book in a couple of senses. One, 90-something% of what you record for a documentary doesn't make it into the documentary. People who I interviewed didn't make it into the documentary. So when it came to writing the book, you know, the wonderful Van Dyke Parks, who in the film might speak a couple of sentences, and then for pacing purposes, you have to cut and move to the next sound bite or piece of music. In the book, I don't have to cut him at all. As long as he's on topic, he can talk. And as you've read, he is wonderful to listen to.
Van Dyke was just on with us a few weeks ago after he got back from his tour of Japan, and he is always fascinating to talk with.
Indeed, indeed.
He
keeps calling it his farewell tour, but I hope he keeps doing that.
I do too. I was wondering, when you first met Brian, could you have possibly imagined not only that he would complete the Smile album, but that a day would come when he would go out and perform it live?
Those are both unimaginable circumstances. Certainly, it was my dream that he would complete the Smile album. It's one of the reasons that I moved to California, was to become a friend, write a book about him, and help him finish Smile in some way. But I didn't really think that was going to happen. It was just, you know, kind of a youthful passion. And especially once I got to know him, it was more about keeping him alive and keeping him healthy as a friend than anything to do with Smile. So it was a good, I would say, 15 years probably before he and I even spoke about Smile in terms of our relationship. In to the second part of your question, the notion that he would go out live and perform it would if you could have gotten a bet down in the Las Vegas books, you would have been able to put lost a lot of money, because there was no way in the world that was going to happen. How could that possibly happen? So A, that he did it so well. From my point of view, he exceeded all of our expectations, dreams, and hopes for the music, and left us with this wonderful dreamscape that was actually a reality.
You talk and revisit the situation back in 1966 and 67 and what stopped the process for him. And I think what you've learned over your research and talking with so many people involved is that there's no one simple answer, that truly there were a lot of factors at play.
Well, you know, when I made Beautiful Dreamer, I felt as a filmmaker that for the film to succeed, Brian would have to tell me why he shelved Smile. That was an essential story point. And I kept asking him, and you know, one time he said, "David, ask better questions." but finally, I asked it in such a way that he says, "Okay, if you want to know from my heart, here are the four reasons why I didn't finish Smile. And then he gives, throughout the interview, he comes up with other reasons. I figured I'd need a year and nobody would give me a year. I felt I needed to do it to save the Beach Boys. I felt I needed to do it to save myself. And then there's a half dozen other reasons that I, add to the story. So there certainly isn't any one reason. There are probably a couple that are at the top of the list, but it's all of them in, one degree or another. And it was really a tragic story as I read it, as fans experienced it, as certainly as Brian and the Beach Boys lived it. And it drove me. I mean, it's just when I first heard about Smile and heard music from Smile, it's like something's wrong here. I got to go out and find out why and fix it.
We're talking with David Leaf. His new book is Smile, The Rise, Fall, and Resurrection of Brian Wilson. In the story of Smile, are there bad guys? Are there heroes and villains, or were there just some misunderstandings and different priorities for guys like Mike Love?
I think, one of the points Brian says, I was a hero and my father was a villain. So I think we have to look at Brian's life in toto to understand the abuse that he suffered, and Dennis too, and Carl to a much lesser degree, I think. And you kind of never recover from that, from everything I understand. So Brian, was always trying to please his father. He always, was going along with his father's notion of loyalty. And so a lot of factors figure into all of this. So if there's a villain, maybe it's Murray Wilson. Certainly the record company is I think to blame, in part because of their demands on him. And their demands on Brian were no different than a record company's demands on any other artist in the 1960s, certainly in the first half of the 1960s. They wouldn't even have used the word artists, really, even though they had A&R departments, artists and repertoire. But artistry, meant, okay, roll, we're rolling, record. It wasn't the business it became. I'm sorry, it wasn't the business as it became later on in the decade, when there were managers who had the strength to stand up for their artists to the record companies and get what their artists wanted. There was nobody like that in Brian's life or world. The Beach Boys didn't really have a manager, where you had Brian Epstein as the Beatles manager, who, despite some of the business errors he made in terms of merchandising and publishing, he stood up. So there was a one for all for one circumstance there with the four Beatles, George Martin, Brian Epstein. And Brian Epstein believed that the Beatles were going to be the greatest thing ever, the biggest band in the world. Murray Wilson believed that the Beach Boys were a family business. And w when you look at things from that perspective, one can't call somebody a villain because he sees it from that point of view, that this is a business and Smile is not good for our business. Certainly Capitol Records didn't think Pet Sounds was good for their business. And so that's why I say the record company is partly to blame here, because if they had gotten behind Pet Sounds, and helped, and I hate this word, rebrand the Beach Boys, if you will, from a group who was known for fun in the sun and surf and cars and girls kind of songs, if they had made it clear that the Beach Boys were grown up, that they were beach men, that these guys who you loved when they talked about getting around in California girls, things were moving in a different direction. And certainly Pet Sounds had the ammunition to do that. You had, with Wouldn't It Be Nice and Sloop Shun B, you had two top 10 hits.
Four top 40 hits off the album.
Four top 40 hits. So why didn't these albums get stickered with includes the four big hits? Sloop Shun B, Wouldn't It Be Nice? God Only Knows, Caroline No. Which would have made people maybe pick it up and not look at the picture of them at a zoo, which did no good for them. Excuse me. And so, you know, their product manager, which gives you an idea of how the music business worked, the guy's name is Carl Ingeman. And he was, by all accounts, a very nice guy. Well, sure, the Beach Boys were churning out hit after hit after hit, big selling album one after another. And he comes back to Brian and the boys after they had brought Pet Sounds to the label and say, you know, gee, guys, everybody, you know, loves the album, but couldn't you give us something more like California Girls? And the answer was no. EMI Records in London, when they heard Revolver that same year, didn't say to the Beatles, hey, couldn't you give us something more like I Want to Hold Your Hand? So there was nobody other than Brian who could fight the artistic battle. He's on his own. He's composing, arranging, and producing. And so starting with that, and then Capitol quickly putting out Best of the Beach Boys, in I think like 6 or 7 weeks after Pet Sounds came out. Now you're in a record store and you pick up two albums. One is a greatest hits album, not particularly a great greatest hits album, but you look at it and go, boy, there's 6 or 7 songs I love. I'm gonna get this one as opposed to this one. And so Pet Sounds was in a sense sabotaged here in the United States. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the UK, thanks in large part to great reviews, in large part to Derek Taylor's brilliant publicity campaign, Andrew Luke Oldham, who was not only the Rolling Stones manager, but I believe the publisher of the Beach Boys music in England. So he had a vested interest in promoting the album. And Bruce Johnston did a one-man publicity tour as well. And Pet Sounds is an enormous success in England. Now, what does Brian care about all of this? What Brian cares about is that he got a phone call from John Lennon and Paul McCartney, right, saying, hey, we just heard Pet Sounds. We love it. Well, that's pretty good. That's a, you know, if you're Brian Wilson, who else matters?
Right.
You've heard Rubber Soul. You say, I'm going to make an album better than Rubber Soul. And those guys call and say, keep doing what you're doing. So he keeps doing what he's doing. Ideas that were unlike anything else in popular music at the time, and Good Vibrations is the next result. And it's a million-selling worldwide number one single. Brian has no reason to think that he's going in the wrong direction until he's told he's going in the wrong direction. And so, you know, the late David Anderley, who was working with Brian at the time, told me that he said with Brian, support was critical, 100% support. He needed everybody to be on his side, and that wasn't the case. Now, were they villains? No, they weren't villains. They were watching out for their interests. As young men, some of them, you know, barely out of high school age, they had homes, they were married, they had children. So they're looking at their lives and what is this smile music going to do to their career? A perfectly reasonable question to ask, as Danny Hutton, who was Brian's best friend, says, I understand completely where Mike was coming from. I just disagreed with him entirely. So that's the kind of the yin and yang of all of this. And, in the oral history that the Smile book is, we get to hear from pretty much everybody.
The abandonment of the Smile Project, was that in many ways the end of the Beach Boys as a cutting edge creative force in music?
Well, I think it was. It wasn't the end for Brian. Shortly after he shelved Smile, he was in the recording studio working on a piece called Can't Wait Too Long, which was as beautiful a composition as anything that was on Smile and what it could have been on Smile, but it was clearly, it wasn't a hit single. It was just this great piece of music. He then started working with a group he named Redwood.
Which was Danny Hutton and the guys who became Three Dog Night, right?
Yep. And he recorded Time to Get Alone with them, which is an amazing piece of music. And Darlin', which was a hit single, which would become a hit single for the Beach Boys. So he had suffered the shelving of Smile was brutal for him. Whether it's a nervous breakdown, an emotional breakdown, whatever you describe it as. But then he gets up off his feet and he gets back to work. I point to the Redwood fiasco as the end of his ambition, if you will. Mm. Because he's working with them for his own label, Brother Records, which was created for non-Beach Boy projects. And Mike Carl and one of the other guys shows up at the studio and basically, as Chuck Negron described it, they corner him in the studio, reducing this strong guy to a little boy right in front of their eyes. And when they leave, he goes out into the studio and says, "Guys, I can't work with you. They say I can't work with you. I'll give you any amount of money you need to finish the record, but I can't do it." So basically what he has now heard is you can't work with other people and the work you want to do with us isn't what we want. So it's really a terrible conundrum for him. And the solution is okay, then I'm not going to work at all. Now, he can't help it. He's a music machine. That's who... He's a guy who just music just pours out of him. And so we get the bastardized version of Smile with Smiley Smile. We get Wild Honey. We get Friends in 2020, which is kind of a hodgepodge. And that's the end of their capital years. And as you said, they very quickly go from being cutting edge, we can't wait to hear what they're doing next, to we don't care what they're doing next.
Yeah, and it's ironic too in many ways. And I'm in my mid 60s. I knew the Beach Boys, loved the music growing up, but really became aware of them and embraced their music with the Endless Summer release. And so many people in the book point to that as well. A number of the guys in the Wonderments who talked about how influential that was for them. And yet those albums, which brought them to a new audience, also in many ways solidified their future as a nostalgia act.
Well, it's really sadly ironic because, you know, I'm older than you are, and so I had watched the early 70s Beach Boys with great hope. And so Holland comes out at the beginning of 73, and there's some great, great music on Holland. I mean, you've got Sail on Sailor, you've got Traitor, you've got this weird fairy tale, you've got the California Saga, you've got Dennis again showing that he can write a beautiful emotional ballad. Mm. It's so there they are. They're growing. They're rebuilding a new audience. And I remember, you know, I went from seeing them, you know, in small places to like a gym at Georgetown University to suddenly they're playing Carnegie Hall. They're playing Madison Square Garden. And they've become a big act again without Endless Summer. When Endless Summer comes out, however, as you say, that solidifies what they are, because there are a lot of people who hear Endless Summer, like Darian Sahanaja from Brian's band, who think that's new music, and they embrace it and they love it. And so what begins is a battle within the Beach Boys, specifically Mike Love and Carl Wilson, as to what their live shows are going to be. And it's how much oldies are we going to play? How much new stuff are we going to play? And it gets even worse, because when they start putting out more new material, it's pretty bad in comparison to where they were. There's right. There's no Sunflower in their future. There's, you know, it's 15 big ones, which somebody, I think it might have been Dennis who called it, I don't remember, somebody called it a half-baked piece of shit. The Bizarre Love You, the unreleased Adult Child, MIU, which was just very bland Beach Boys, and it gets worse.
Yeah.
So those of us who kept buying new Beach Boys albums and expecting something great were continually disappointed. And so they become more and more of an oldies act. And then in 1981, Carl Wilson leaves the Beach Boys, saying, I'll come back when they say 1981 is as important as 1961. And he makes a couple of solo records and comes back eventually, in part because his brother Dennis dies. So it's the Beach Boys story, though, for me, ends there. There's more records to come. There's lots of tours to come. But, you know, as I said earlier, as Brian's friend, having become Brian's friend, I'm more concerned about his life and the roller coaster that he's on with all sorts of issues, including this weird psychologist who, as Brian describes his life with him, Brian says it was like 9 years in prison. So I was more concerned with helping him get out of jail. Smile wasn't on the radar.
Well, we're talking with David Leaf. The rise and the resurrection of Brian, in many ways, began certainly with meeting Melinda, but also when he finally got up and did what I think few expected, and I think was it 90, 98 or so, and started going out and performing live again. I remember seeing him, I think, on that first trip out down in Boston, and you know, you could tell he was a bit uneasy about it, but the voice was strong, the band was great.
So just to step back a second, in the Smile story, the first big step is the 1993 box set, Good Vibrations, 30 Years of the Beach Boys Best. And when I went over the track listing of it with Brian, I was one of the producers of the compilation. I said, Brian, you know, there's this giant hole between the Good Vibrations single and the Heroes and Villains single. And he goes, well, what do you mean? I said, well, you worked on all this Smile stuff. I'm not asking you to finish it, but I think it would be great if we could include some of it. And he said, okay. I mean, there wasn't even a debate. He didn't know hesitation, because I wasn't telling him we have to include it. I was just saying, in my opinion, I think there's this hole there that we should be filling. And then he said, okay, what songs do you think we should put there? And I pretty much quickly rattled off the material that's on the box set. I purposely didn't mention Mrs. O'Leary's Cow, because that was one of the songs that supposedly had been at the kind of the top of the tailspin Brian went into during the original Smile era. So getting that Smile music out into the world was a big deal. The press just ate it up. The box set went gold, which I think for box sets was a pretty unusual circumstance. And, you know, Smile music had been released and the world hadn't come to an end. And so, again, there was no thought that he was going to go out and play it live. The Beach Boys actually did a few of the Smile songs in 93 when the box set came out. When Brian started touring, he did a live concert that was recorded in 98, and then 99 he started touring, really to promote the Imagination album. And if that hadn't happened, there would have been no Pet Sounds Tour. There would have been no Brian Wilson Presents Smile. So the two things that happened were, one, he was willing to go out and tour, and then he started enjoying it, some nights less than others. But in the assemblage of this great band, what he realized was he had a group of people who were dedicated to playing his music both note perfect and feel perfect, so that he could sit there very proudly singing along, occasionally playing, but and know that his music was being presented in the way he had originally intended it for it to be heard. So it was really a remarkable thing. I was at the Boston show you mentioned. I remember, the very first 4 dates, which began in Ann Arbor, Michigan, in the middle of a blizzard. It was surreal in the extreme when we walked by the theater marquee and it said an evening with Brian Wilson. It was like, how could this be? But there was no talk of Smile. In fact, if the band members, particularly the members of the Wondermans who were fans, deep fans of Brian, if they brought up here, hey, what about doing Heroes and Villains or anything like that, Brian would say, please don't mention those songs to me. It reminds me of a really unhappy time in my life. So you couldn't even talk to Brian about Smile. And we're talking about 1998 into 1999, into 2000. And at the end of 2000, at a Christmas party at Scott Bennett's house, Brian played Heroes and Villains at the piano as a Christmas gift for my wife. And all of a sudden, he's willing. People are like, what is going on? And I said, Brian, you really should play that at the tribute next year. That I was writing and producing a tribute to Radio City Music Hall in 2001 for him, never expecting that he was actually going to be produced performing at it and have a band assembled. I'd been trying to sell it for years and years and years. Anyway, when I said, well, you should do Heroes, he said, okay. And when he did it that night, following the Boys Choir of Harlem performing Our Prayer, following Vince Gill, David Crosby, and Jimmy Webb doing Surf's Up, and Ann and Nancy Wilson doing Good Vibrations, he gets a standing ovation for Heroes and Villains. And in front of his eyes, he sees that Smile music is not, going to bring the world crashing down. It's not, it's in fact, people want to hear it. And so they start adding a song or two to his set in throughout 2001 and into 2002. When he tours England in 2002 with Pet Sounds, as he had done in the United States in 2001, I'm sorry, in 2000, the question became, okay, what do you follow this with? And so the distant drums started beating. Well, we should be following Pet Sounds with the same thing he wanted to follow Pet Sounds with 37 years ago. It's Smile.
And as you capture so well in the book, with the stories of so many people who were involved, the process was certainly fraught. And I feel like right up until they took the stage in London, there was some question whether this would actually come to pass.
I think in the back of our mind, or maybe even more towards the frontal lobes, we were all wondering, is he going to do this? In fact, I had said to my director of photography on the Beautiful Dreamer documentary, I want you to follow Brian up the steps. And I said to him, I said, I feel like it's going to be Dead Man Walking as he kind of plods up the steps, like he's facing his biggest fear. The thing that surprised me about the book and the recounting and the oral history and the memories of everybody that I sequenced there is it's very clear that Brian is going to do this. If you've read the inner flap of the book, you know that he's going to do this. If you've read the introduction, you know he's going to do this. And yet, because I had interviewed everybody before the world premiere, there's this sense of tension in all of their answers. There's this uncertainty. I mean, he's already driven himself to the emergency room once. Who knows what else is going to happen? And so we were nervous. You see him in the film sitting in the empty the Royal Festival Hall, just wanting to be by himself, meditating and thinking and kind of pep talking him into this challenge of overcoming the tremendous fear that he had, and then summoning the courage to go on stage and do it.
And the first night, it was almost like just getting over that hurdle, but several comments from band members in the book that the second night was when they could enjoy it and appreciate even more of the feedback from the audience that they were getting and revel in performing this great music.
Yeah, the first night was, you know, music. You know, I did 25 new interviews for the book, but in addition to what I had, and I asked everybody to talk about that first night, and to look back on it and what it meant, and try to put it all in perspective, because I had stopped interviewing everybody by the time we got to London. Now it was time to hear what Brian had to say, because when I interviewed Brian before we went to London, it was a disaster. He just didn't want to talk. And so when he came back from the first Smile tour, he was an absolute chatterbox about it. I mean, he called me the day he got back, because we had stayed in London for the entire run of the world premiere week, and then flown back and gotten to work editing. And he called me and said, "David, you have to come over tomorrow with a camera. We have to do an interview." Which I'm willing to bet was the first time since 1966 he had ever wanted to do an interview, let alone an interview about Smile. And when I got there, I said, what's up? He says, "David, you're not going to believe it. Smile got better and better every night." And I said, "Well, what do you mean? How did he get better?" And he looked at me like I was a moron, like it was an idiotic question. He says, "Well, the singing got better, the playing got better, the audiences got better, it just got better." And I said, "So on a scale of 1 to 10, where do you rank Pet Sounds and Smile?" And he says, "Well, on a scale of 1 to 10, I'll give Pet Sounds a 4 and Smile a 10. Now, in subsequent interviews, he would raise Pet Sounds to a 7.
Right.
But it gives you an idea of how great he knew this music was, which also gives you an idea of the albatross he had been carrying around all those years, that I created this incredible body of work that just is sitting on a shelf. And so there was a tremendous triumph of the human spirit in him doing this. And he said in this interview, he said, "David, you're not going to believe it. For the first time in my career, I can't wait to get back on the road again."
I love the story in the book of the fourth night in London and Paul McCartney coming in to join in the pre-show circle. And then I was tearing up reading about him waiting in the wings to shake everybody's hand.
You know, there is nobody in the universe like Paul McCartney. You know, in a previous generation, you would have talked about Frank Sinatra as somebody who was Frank, you know, was great, did things in private that were wonderful that you didn't know about. But Frank was also an incredibly, or Mr. Sinatra, I should say, was an incredibly public figure with all sorts of romances and marriages and broken marriages. Sir Paul, in my opinion, is as perfect a public figure as anyone in history. If you are lucky enough to meet him, he gives you exactly the Paul McCartney experience you're hoping for. Whether it's 30 seconds or 3 minutes or a half hour, it's like he knows how to do a mind meld and be Paul McCartney. So he purposely didn't come opening night. And I think he didn't come opening night because the reviews would have been Paul McCartney there to see Brian Wilson perform Smile. He understands that he would have drawn attention away from this historic moment. So he doesn't come. So he comes the fourth night. He's there to cheer Brian on. He's there to cheer the band on. He joins the circle. For each of them, it was a life moment that they couldn't forget. And they describe it and they talk about what it was like to be on stage and know that Paul McCartney is watching them. Even though he had come to, I think he had come to a Pet Sounds show, at least one Pet Sounds show before.
I love Abe Laborio's comment, absolute religious experience. It was truly like going to church and seeing the history of music all condensed into one.
Well, so the result of Paul coming on night four is he says to his band members, Abe and Brian and everybody, he says, you've got to go see this Smile concert. And they come the next night. And Abe is just, besides being an incredible drummer, just a sweetheart. And I love that quote because there is, you know, Brian said, I'm writing a teenage symphony to God when he embarked on Smile. Now, what the heck does that mean? You read it as a quote, what was in his head? Who knows exactly? But then when you experience it, as Abe did, it does feel religious. It does feel like you're communing with everybody in the room, everybody on the stage, with the ages. And that's why I talk about, you know, there's this Church of Brian Wilson.
And I love the comments from people that as great as the recording of the concert was, that this is music that in many ways was made to be experienced live the way it was when they took to the road.
You know, I love it better live than in person, than the recording. I'm sorry. There's something about watching him get through the album that's really special. Now I have the video of the world premiere. I can watch it start to finish. No one else has it. It's only been seen once. We had an event in 2009 at UCLA where I had endowed a Brian Wilson scholarship, and we held a special occasion to give the first scholarship out, and also to those who had contributed to the scholarship fund. They were invited, and Brian was there, and we did an interview with he and I and Probert Gregory on stage, but we showed that concert. It's the only time it's ever been seen. And it's just magical. It's just unbelievable. And I one of these days I hope there'll be a streamer who'll want it, because it is a completely different experience than the recording. The recording is incredible. Brian is singing great on the record. The guys in the band are singing great. Now, that said, nobody can equal the Beach Boys for their vocal blend. And we heard that when the Smile Sessions came out in 2011. But there's a spirit to Brian's band. Remember, what we're witnessing when you watch the Brian and his band play this live with the Stockholm strings and horns, you're seeing something that never existed before, because in 1966, Brian recorded the backing tracks with the A-list musicians, his session players, and then the Beach Boys sang. What Brian's band is doing on stage is both at the same time. And so how are they doing it? Well, they're doing it with love and dedication and passion and feeling. And so I think that's why a lot of us feel that watching it live is a more rewarding experience. That said, the record is pretty great.
I love the essays at the end of the book. My friend Peter Ames Carlin with a wonderful story about his son meeting Brian during a show.
I love that.
And then that very personal and poignant essay that your friend Debbie Leavitt wrote. It's just a wonderful way to wrap up this wonderful story of redemption.
Thank you. I really, I refer early in the book to the notion of the smile story being like looking through a kaleidoscope. And I look through the kaleidoscope one way and then turn it a little bit, and someone else is looking at it another way. And I wanted as many voices as possible in the book, which is why there's an entire chapter of people who saw the Royal Festival Hall shows, and then there's another chapter of people who saw the tour somewhere else in the world. But there were people who I felt had a connection that went beyond just a sentence or two or a paragraph. And so, for example, Peter No, Peter Carlin's essay is just, I just love it, because the idea of Brian saying to somebody, "Wait till you hear this, it'll knock your socks off." It's so unlike the image anyone has of who Brian Wilson is. So I love a moment like that. I loved getting Tom Nolan to write an essay for the anthology, because it was his article in 1971 that sent me on this wild obsessive journey, and a lot of other people along the way who had something to say that I thought really fit the anthology. It just, as I say early in the book, I've had my say. In God Only Knows, there's two chapters on Smile. In Beautiful Dreamer, there's an entire movie about it. In the Brian Wilson Presents Smile CD, I wrote the liner notes. So it's like I've had a lot to say about it. So I really wanted this book to be what other people thought, as much as that was possible. I'm kind of a Greek chorus from time to time, contextualizing and chiming in and adding my two cents where I think it's necessary. But for the most part, this is other people's voices, a lot of other people's voices. So it's sort of like being in a room. You're sitting in the center of maybe a couple of dozen people, and each one is telling a piece of the story, and you're looking there and you're looking there, and the story just folds like it's just a conversation, almost like you're a general and you're getting a briefing on the battle plans, and each person's got something to tell you about what you need to know before you go into battle.
Well, I love the way you described it, because I felt that reading it, like I'm in the room where it happened. I'm here listening to the guys in the band, listening to David Anderley, listening to Van Dyke, yourself, and all the people who made this this beautiful dream come to fruition all those years later.
Thank you. Yeah, I kind of can't believe I did it, because it wasn't my intention. When I contacted the publisher who had put out God Only Knows in 2022, the then editor in chief, David Berikoff, and told him I wanted to do a book to celebrate the 20th anniversary of Brian Wilson Presents Smile, he said, "What's your idea?" I said, "Well, I've got all these interviews from Beautiful Dreamer that 99% of them haven't been read or heard. I'd like to just do a book of interviews." He goes, "Nah, interview books don't do well for us. But if you want to do it as an oral history, we'd be interested." And I'm so glad in retrospect that he said that, because this is a much more satisfying way to tell the story. You referred to the guys in the band. One of the things that surprised me every time I proofed it, every time I went through a PDF of it to check for errors, and when I would get to 2003, early 2004, it was like I could feel the tension. What's going to happen? And it was like, wait a second, I know what's going to happen. Why do I feel this time after time after time? And so I think that's really, I know that's some kind of magic trick that we pulled off in the book. Because of, just the sheer honesty of the people involved. They didn't hesitate, they didn't hold back.